Patricia Camilleri, Director of the Communications and Alumni Relations Office here at the University. In this series called Research Matters, I shall be discussing a wide range of research projects in which our academics are currently involved. I'm delighted to have with me today a very special guest. He's Dr. Thomas Anastasi-Parch. Having graduated BSc in 1934 and then MD in 1937, he's certainly amongst our earliest living alumni. This year we've organised a number of events to raise awareness amongst our alumni, of whom there are currently in Malta and all around the world about 30,000. And I must say that Dr. Anastasi-Parch was one of the first people to use our online alumnus form to provide us with his details. A very warm welcome to you, Dr. Anastasi-Parch.
Thank you.
Well, considering all the fascinating and varied aspects of my guest's life, I hesitate to try and encapsulate it in a few words. But just as an outline introduction, I could say that Dr. Anastasi-Parch was born in 1914. His father was also a doctor, Professor Joseph Anastasi-Parch, who was for some time the doctor of the Lazzaretto on Manuel Island, where our guest and his siblings spent some of their childhood. After graduating as a medical doctor, as I said, in 1937, Dr. Anastasi-Parch joined the British Army, the RAMC, the Royal Army Medical Corps, and spent some years in England before being sent to India and the Far East. He saw active service in Burma, for which he was awarded the OBE in 1945. After the war, his work took him all over the world. Germany, right after the war, Singapore, Paris, Cyprus during the Troubles there. And then he worked in Brussels at SHAPE, the Supreme Headquarters, Allied Powers Europe, for a few years before retiring. He continued to do army locums in London, where he still lives, and still regularly joins in military marches, until recently participating also in the Remembrance Day march to the Cenotaph in London's Whitehall. Dr. Anastasi-Parch's travels have also meant that he was able to pick up several languages, I understand, French, German, Italian, Urdu, Russian, Turkish, and possibly others as well, and still, of course, remembers his Maltese. He was married to a lady from Wales, who I believe he met while they were both serving in India. Dr. Anastasi-Parch, tell us a little about those early years on Manuel Island. I gather you actually went to school using a Dicer and a Carrotzin?
We did. It was a daily shuffle, really. An ordinary Dicer, yes, with one man rowing, and it used to be great fun in the summer particularly, and spring. In the winter, not so often. In the winter, then one had to go to catch a bus from Gzeera.
Of course, because that if one wants to go to Valletta on a Dicer from Manuel Island, you have to turn that very rough corner into the harbour.
You did, yes, indeed, to cross down, and you landed near the ferry, next door to the ferry.
That's it, and it's quite a pull up then.
And then climbed up Sala San Marco, I think it was, through the tunnel and on to school or university.
And you actually did that run even when you started university?
Yes, because we were still at Lazzaretto and I qualified.
We have with us a photograph of the class of 37, which was included in a recent exhibition that we held at the theatre at the old university in Valletta. It, of course, includes yourself and many others who have become very well-known members of the Malta Society. What can you tell us about the atmosphere at the university in those pre-war days?
Well, I can tell you, the only thing we ever discussed at the university was either politics or football. Politics being by far and away the preponderating subject.
I can imagine that. Politics in Malta, little changes.
Those were the very turbulent years.
Absolutely.
And there was fierce rivalry, if you like, or competition, but we were very firmly either in one camp or another.
And the rivalry was also between the faculties?
There was, not so strong, but we used to play them at football or that sort of thing. But the main impression of my years at the university were politics.
And you used to join in the club and use your time, not only studying, of course. What else did you do with your moments there?
Fierce arguments, political again. I remember my fiercest rival was Cesare Tavola, and he and I, great friends as we were then and as we have remained, but we were at the exact antipodes one from the other. But they were great days. It was great fun. Looking back on it, I don't regret it.
No, I'm sure it was. I think that most people, even if they at the time find their years a bit difficult, I think then when they look back, they always sort of seem to appreciate the freedom that one has as a student to relax and talk about things that when you're in the world of work, of course,
yes, indeed,
you cannot do. And so your closest friends, you would say, were Cesare Tavola, and were there others that you remember in particular?
Well, in my year, yes, there was Zamit Mempel, François Gerarda, Tommy Warrington, of course, he was another great chum of mine, and he joined the army soon after I did. George Camilleri, I remember them all. We were all very, very closely in it.
And I noticed from the picture that there are some very interesting personages who were lecturers, obviously, at the time, including P.P. de Bono.
Pietro Paolo was professor of surgery. Lul was professor of midwifery and gynecology. He was another very well-known. And I remember them all, really. There was Professor Schwerup, Professor Bernard, the great pioneer of hygiene in Malta. Who were the others? Professor Vassallo was the mental diseases. Professor Vincenti was the pathologist.
Yes, these are all names that have sort of remained in the sort of the intellectual history.
I don't doubt it. Yes, indeed.
And also the rector, Robbie Gallia.
And the rector,
your
Professor
memories
Gallia.
Of the rector.
Yes, he was an architect, of course, he was, yeah.
Of course, at that time, the numbers were small. I think you were about...
Very small. The average faculty would have about 15, 20 at the most.
You wouldn't, really, on speaking terms on friendship terms with virtually the whole the whole of the university,
no.
Or you kept a small group?
You kept a clique of your own faculty, more or less.
But you certainly know who the rector, for example, was. Here we have 10,000
yes.
students. I'm sure some of them sort of just see the rector
on
their first day.
There you saw him every day pretty nearly, and he knew every one of us by name.
Do you remember any particular anecdotes about those years? Anything that sort of sticks in your memory? Did the students go on rag day at that time?
No.
No, yeah, that
no,
wasn't part of the tradition
no,
at that
no
moment.
No rag days. No. We were, I suppose, on the whole, we were rather serious when you come to think of it. Certainly, for example, when we graduated, we had none of this modern hanky-panky that they go on.
You heard some of that this morning, didn't you?
That's right, yes.
Yes, we had a soapy pool in front of the rector's office last week and various other things that happened.
No, we had none of that.
Uh-huh. Immediately after your graduation, you joined the army. What made you so enthusiastic about army life? Was it because had seen service?
I'll tell you exactly. I was born 5 days before the outbreak of the last war, of the first war. And my father, who was a doctor, he joined the Royal Army Medical Corps as a volunteer. And soon after I was born, he went to Palestine and never came back until 1921, when I was 7 years old.
Gosh.
So all the time until I was seven, all I knew about my father, he was a Captain J. Anastasi, Royal Army Medical Corps, and he was abroad in the war. And one of my very earliest recollections is Armistice Day, 1918, when I was 4 years old. And the bells were ringing all over the place, and my mother saying, "This is the end of the war, and it means that your father will be coming home." Well, it took him another 3 years before he came home.
Gosh, to get demobbed, it took 3 years?
Yes, he stayed there until 1921. Yes. And so I should imagine he must have influenced me, knowingly or unknowingly. And from the time I was 10 years old, until then I had wanted to become a fire engine driver, a kilted Scots soldier and all that sort of thing. But from the time I was 10, I made a firm decision, believe it or believe it not, that I would become a doctor and join the Royal Army Medical Corps. And I never wavered.
And never regretted that decision?
Never regretted it for a moment. If and when I write my book, it will be called No Regrets or Pacing Through Life.
Talk about wartime Burma, of course, conjures up some pretty awful images. When you ended up there, what memories do you have of that period of your army life?
Well, one of the earliest memories was going actually into action for the first time. None of us knew anything very much about the Japs when war broke out. So it was all very much of untested territory. I was commanding a field ambulance then, which was our job was to take care of the sick and wounded, collect them, treat them, and send them back to the base hospitals and things like that. And we were what we called brigaded. We were with a particular brigade. The first evening, it must have been, that we went into action, one of the staff officers came into my unit and he said to me, "Well, Tommy, we think that the Jap will invade us tonight. And if he will, he will pass through your lines." So I said to him, "Well, I'm very glad that you seem so happy about it." I said to him, "Who's going to defend me, my unit, meaning my unit?" He said, "Well, nobody." He said, "We've got to look after yourselves." Because they were short of personnel and everything. So the only thing I could, we were in what we called a nala, a little valley. And the only thing I could think of was to build a protective wall with boxes of dressings and medicines. Now, the dressings meant, of course, a vast amount of cotton wool. And you can imagine what effect a bullet, in the way of protecting us, a bullet coming through cotton wool would be.
Not very useful.
Anyway, so we all stood too, as the phrase was, to you stand, to stay awake, in other words, guarding, if you can call it guarding, this stone wall, this breast-high wall of boxes. Anyway, luckily the night, as far as my ambulance was concerned, passed without incident. The Jap did come through, unfortunately, but he came through the other units, the infantry units, and they bore the brunt, of course, of the battle, but we survived intact.
You must have been considered yourselves very fortunate to actually have got back at all.
And the following morning, at dawn, we had to stand to until dawn, you saw a line of rather weird soldiers with their rifles, of course, and we all trooped off to a bit of breakfast that we could raise, rather thankful that the Jap had left us alone.
Quite so. You're posting in Germany, but post-war Germany. I imagine that would have been quite a difficult posting because things really must have been very, very bad in Germany at that time.
It was
before
indeed.
The Marshall Plan kicked in. And
I remember my first, I was stationed not far from Cologne. And I remember when I first went down to Cologne, the devastation there from the bombing was still apparent, of course, so this was barely a year, within a year of the end of the war. And as far as I can remember, there was, apart from the cathedral, which was untouched, there wasn't one single building standing above the ground floor. It was a terrifying spectacle, really, of what damage bombing can do.
And also, of course, the spirit of the people must have been so low at that time as well.
Well, it was. It must have been, because rations were scarce, of course. Everything was scarce. And,
but I think that you have had a love of music and this sort of thing. And a love of the German culture, obviously, that sort of went beyond any political
considerations. Yes, we soon arrived at the theatre, and in the village where I was, or the town, Hilden, a place called Hilden, the opera came down either from Munich, I can't remember from where, it wasn't a local opera company. But they came and they gave us proper operas, ending up with playing God Save the King at the end, needless to say, because they had to. And it was most enjoyable. I went to all the shows there.
Must have been slightly surreal, though, I would imagine.
Anyway, it was, yes. We were all in uniform, of course. All the British Army had to be in uniform. But the crowd, they were... We never had any anti-British either riots or hostility shown to us by none at all.
Mm. Your other postings sound equally fascinating. Singapore, you've been in Paris.
Well, they were. You see, I had a very lucky career, I consider, because whether what we call permanent or temporary duty, I must have served everywhere where the British soldier was, except the West Indies and West Africa. But I went everywhere else on duty, from Lisbon to Hong Kong, and from Oslo in the north to the island of Mauritius in the south.
Wow.
I was very lucky. I went to North Africa, East Africa, of course, Kenya, Uganda, Tanganyika, Zanzibar, and, of course, Mauritius. I was in Egypt, Cyprus, pretty nearly everywhere, as I call it.
And in the postings, were you there sort of long enough to be able to sort of create bonds with the people you were working with, or was it a too short a posting to be able to feel that way?
No, most German, for example, I had two tours of 1 year each there, and that gave me ample time to mix. I had lots and lots of civilian friends, indeed. So I enjoyed every posting, really and truly.
And what about the picking up of the languages? How did you sort of manage
to do that? Well, I am a bit of a language fiend. Languages are my hobby, really. And I used to make a point of picking up the language wherever I was. When I first went to Germany, I knew was Guten Morgen and Guten Abend. And I was at the station waiting to go from A to B, and I saw a driver looking under the engine and telling his pal it was kaput. Well, the only word kaput that I knew then was Latin for a head. So I thought perhaps somebody had been run over or something. And I set about learning German properly, you know, and I used to suffer from insomnia in those days, so of course if I woke up in the middle of the night, I picked up a dictionary or a grammar. So this is how I picked up my languages.
When you look back at those postings, is there one particular place that sticks out in your memory as somewhere where you would have perhaps liked to have returned to?
I can't say there was, because I was a fickle man, really. Having spent 2 or 3 years in one spot and adored every minute of it, the moment the plane took off and I was going to my next posting, that was all behind me.
You were ready
and
for
I
the
was
next
ready to start a new
next
life,
journey.
So
next journey.
But I loved everywhere where I was.
Mm-hmm. Going back to the university, your university years, the University of Malta is your alma mater, but clearly you haven't been here for many years. But what do you feel about you? Remember it in general with fondness?
Oh, I do, with a great fondness. 7 years, you see, in my time it used to be. for the BSc plus the MD. And it was a small building, the one of Valletta. Quite a small building, so you knew every part of it. And you commuted, in our case, from there to the Central Civil Hospital, which was then at Floriana, where the police are now, I believe. And as we said earlier, we were a small faculties. In my case, I think we were 11 or 12. So you really got to know each other very, very well, and you made great bonds of friendship.
So your clinical training was done all in one hospital? Or?
Yes, at the Central Civil.
Mm-hmm. So the alumni that we have, people like yourself who've moved abroad and have that kind of experience, we're really looking to try and look at them as a great resource for the university, for our own students, because I think that it's important that this experience doesn't sort of just sort of get lost, but also sort of comes back again to us.
Yes, and I think this idea of forming the Alumni Association is absolutely first class.
Good.
I think it's terrific. I sincerely hope there'll be an annual luncheon at some time.
Yes, we're looking to do all sorts of things, because now we're having this, we have this database, which you're already on, and we're encouraging all our alumni to go online and give us their details and tell us where they are now and all the rest of it. One question which I wanted to ask you, because I'm very interested in gender issues, is whether you noticed that you had three women in your course in 1937.
Well, yes, we had, in my own faculty, Faculty of Science, we had two. Mary Carvana and Ondina Tayar. Yeah. And of course it was an innovation then. Girl students were very, very rare at the university.
Mm-hmm. In fact, I think Ondina Tayar and Mary Carvana, I think, were the first PhCs.
They were, that's right. Okay.
So unusual.
Yes, indeed.
And
when we then went on to do medicine, of course, we had, in my particular faculty, we did.
We had, there was Marcel Galanopoulou.
No, not in my lot.
Oh, not in your lot.
No, in my lot we had... I am ashamed to say.
The lawyer, the first lawyer was graduated in 1937, as not as a lawyer, but as, I think, notary public. She was Joanna Bonacci. She was, but
yes,
that's again.
I remember the name quite well.
They were probably a bit younger, so not in your group.
3 years junior.
They would have been. Nowadays, would you think that a doctor joining the army would have the same kind of career that you had, or has the figure of the army doctor changed over
the years? He won't be able to, you see, because in my days the empire was still existing as a very large tract of territory. But what they would have more experience of today would be war, of course, because they do 6 months in Afghanistan, and if they're lucky, 6 months back home, and then off again for another stint.
So a different kind of medical life, really, a different kind of army life, anyway.
It's quite different, yes, indeed.
Well, it's been absolutely wonderful talking to you, Dr. Anastasi Pach. I really thank you for coming in today to Campus FM.
It's a pleasure.
And we shall certainly be sending you all our information about our alumni activities, and look forward to seeing you with us again. I know that you do come and go from London.
So, I do, yes.
Hopefully we'll be seeing you over here again soon. Thank you very, very much.
Thank you very much.
If you would like further details about the University of Malta's research projects or any other information, please access our website at www.um.edu.mt. Do join me again next week. This is Patricia Camilleri saying goodbye.